online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Oenologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, to mark International Women's Day, a special edition dedicated to pioneers Dr. Laura Catena, Dr. Rachel Barry, Louisa Rose, Sarah Pidgeon, Teresa Heutzenreuder, Natalie Christensen, Corinne Seeley, Sherry Spriggs, and Jancis Robinson, OBE, MW. This week's edition is released on International Women's Day. So, to mark the occasion, we revisit a few of the interviews with female pioneers to whom we've spoken over the past 150 episodes, nearly 3 years of The Drinking Hour. First, Dr. Laura Catena. The name is wine royalty. Her father, Nicolas Catena Zapata, a pioneer of Argentinian wine. But she chose to fly the nest to train in medicine in the United States, becoming a paediatrician in the emergency room, what we call A&E, before returning to the family fold to take over the reins from her father, who she told me was himself inspired by his mother.
Well, you know, he grew up in a tiny, tiny little village, less than 1,000 people. And, you know, he went to school on a horse. And he had this mother, Angelica Zapata. We actually have a wine named after her, my grandmother, who I never met because she died young. But she was the local headmistress of this little country school. And she was a fierce educator. My father says she was a better teacher than mother because she didn't cook much for her kids. She was always teaching any student that needed extra help. They could come to the house every evening, every weekend. And he grew up in this family where education was so important. And I think that's a big part of why he was able to do what he did in Argentina, because, you know, he went to the U.S. As a visiting scholar to UC Berkeley in the early 80s, partly because, you know, Argentina was during the military government. My uncle had been kidnapped. My father was very worried for our family, for, you know, what was happening in Argentina. There were bombs put on all the time. You know, I would walk to school and there was a person with a machine gun in the corner. And so my father said, let's leave for a little bit. And he continued to run the winery by fax. They didn't have computers back then. And the wonderful thing about going to the U.S. Was that he saw this revolution that was happening in the Napa Valley. He heard about the Judgment of Paris, led by I'm sure you knew Steven Spurrier, one of my wine world heroes, just this incredible person. And, you know, what was amazing about Steven was that he did this Judgment of Paris where, you know, the California wines were compared to the best French wines. But then he continued to support that concept for the rest of the world. And, you know, he and I had this incredible conversation with my father, with Stephen, about how, you know, what California had done to show that there was grand terroir, you know, grand cru sites in California, we could also do in Argentina. And really, that's what my father set out to do. He said, I'm going to show the world that we can make, you know, grand cru worthy wines out of Mendoza. And it was this vision that, you know, basically led everything we did, and that still inspires us today. You know, we're doing the same thing with the same vision that my father had, you know, whatever, 3 decades ago.
Argentina, rightly or wrongly, has this quite macho image, I think linked to the gaucho, probably. Mm-hmm. But you've had a very supportive relationship, obviously, with your father. But have you encountered obstacles along the way from males?
Well, I would say that our winery, you know, we are so pro-female. You know, my father had this really strong mother, the school teacher. He has always hired women. But when I started, we didn't have that many women in high positions at the winery. That has been a big change that happened after I came. And what I find is, You know, they say that in order to attract more women, you need to have women in your staff. And that is true. If a woman looks at a company and they see that there is no high-level person that's a female, well, they're going to be suspicious of you saying, yes, we have great opportunities for women, because they say, well, if you have such great opportunities, why are there not more women in high-level positions? And so I did have to, you know, hire more women and promote women. But, you know, I'm always looking for the best person for the job. I just happened to meet a lot of great women. So our winery right now has a lot of women in top positions. But to your question about did I face any issues, you know, I came from medicine where today there's more female doctors than male doctors. So I came from a kind of work that was very egalitarian. You know, for sure, there's sexism in all worlds, but I came from that world. So when I came to the winery, I feel like perhaps there were things that happened that I didn't even notice because I wasn't really looking for them. On the other hand, I have to say that I feel like in the world in general, in Latin America, in the business world, there is still, you know, a lot of domination by men in the sense that a lot of the high-level positions in businesses in Latin America are for men. There's more men in high-level positions, more male CEOs, more male CFOs, more leaders that are men. And that to me is a problem because, you know, if we want to progress as a region, Latin America, we need to incorporate more women because not only are women wonderful workers, but there's a lot of literature that diverse groups where there's a better balance of men or women make more money. You know, boards that have women, companies that have more women make more money. So when you get a diverse group, you think more creatively, you get the you know, I don't know, the teams that are co-ed, I think do better work. And I find this at our winery. So I personally do not think I've had to struggle greatly because of this, you know, partly also because I came into the family as my father's daughter. And, you know, I really see that as a privilege that I hope to never forget that, you know, I had a privilege that other people didn't have.
Dr. Laura Catena on how Latin American business should encourage equality. Dr. Rachel Barry is a scientist with chemistry her specialism, but she's best known as the First Lady of Scotch, the first woman to hold the title Master Blender, the first female to be inducted into the Scotch Whisky Hall of Fame. She now oversees Glendronach, Benriach and Glenglassa distilleries for Brown Forman. She spoke to me for our 100th episode, talking about the importance of teamwork in blending.
The beauty is in the discussion, isn't it? It's in the shared awareness. It's in the consciousness. It's in the learning from each other. It's in the shared experience. You know, I just love that. It's a big part of what I enjoy, actually, about whisky making, is that sharing with the team at work or indeed with drinkers and consumers and having the chat and understanding more about how different people or as individuals, how we perceive things slightly differently sometimes, you know, depending on our potential blind spots to different aromatics or indeed our own memories, experiences or where we were brought up, in which geography in the world, you know, and the foods and the nature that we've been brought up with. That really, you know, inform the way we describe whisky. You know, I used to have an assistant who came up with a description for tasting notes of snickerdoodle. And I was like, what's a snickerdoodle? I've never heard of that. And of course, he was Canadian. So he knew fine well what it was. But, you know, these kind of differences between us as humans are what makes life interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Talking of differences, you must work with plenty of blokes. Do you think you do your job any differently to them because of your gender?
I don't think so at all. From my perspective, we're all individuals and we have individual journeys. And what is gender anyway? You know, I would question that in terms of doing your job, using the left and right hemispheres of your brain to be analytical, to be creative, to be expressive. empathic. All of these qualities and human attributes, you know, they are, they're not gender specific. They're very individual. You know, I think the richness comes from, you know, us being individuals and having experienced many different paths in life. And, you know, and we all put ourselves into our work, you know, we all have a slightly different perspective. So for me, it's not definitely not a barrier. It's an opportunity for richness, having different individuals involved in the whiskey industry.
You are a pioneer, though, as modest as you might be about it. The first female master blender, as I mentioned, the first Scottish woman to be in the Whiskey Hall of Fame. Have you encountered obstacles along the way in terms of attitudes towards you being a woman doing a job that had at that point been done by men?
I've experienced a lot of attitudes in my life. From women and men, you know, people have attitudes, you know, about everything, don't they? Some people feel strongly about different things and some people don't. So I've always had the philosophy that other people's attitudes are none of my business. So that, for me, means, you know, nothing really kind of stood in my way from that perspective, because I've you know, nothing's really bothered me, to be honest. You know, I've had a family. I've got, you know, I've got three boys. I've, you know, got a brother. I've got a dad. You know, I've got I'm surrounded by men, and they're all individuals as well, and they've all got different attitudes. So again, I don't think gender has had a part to play at all from my perspective.
What advice would you give to women who want to succeed in roles still dominated by men?
Well, I think, you know, you know, you have to love what you do, most importantly. I think, you know, in any job, you know, life is short. let's be serious about this. And you really want to, pick a path you're going to enjoy. And, you know, working with people that, you know, you're going to enjoy working with. And, you know, just go for it and learn, be curious. That, for me, that is the biggest skill. If you can continue to be curious, ask questions and have the courage as well. If you face any hurdles, you overcome them. You will, you know, you'll be so much stronger for it. And I think you've just got to go for it. There's a place, definitely a place for everyone who's keen to work in the whiskey industry. If you're interested, if you're keen, if you're curious, just go for it. You know, there's nothing stopping you but yourself, really. I think nowadays it's if you've got the passion, that's going to shine through and you're going to get the job.
Some sage advice from Dr. Rachel Barry. Sarah Pidgeon is one half of one of wine's most enduring double acts. Co-chief winemaker with Sue Hodder at Wynns Coonawarra for well over two decades. It's celebrated for Cabernet Sauvignon from the Terra Rossa soils. I asked her about her partnership with Sue, but first we talked about how she entered the wine world.
As with many people, it was not a part of a family business for me. But certainly it was part of a culture at home. When I was a kid in the 1980s, I had parents who loved their wine. And I think, you know, in the 1980s Australia, that was probably a little bit unusual. There was a lot more beer-drinking families than wine-drinking ones. So it did mark us out as a little different, enjoying wine in the 1980s. And so really, I have memories of them enjoying wine, and some of the wines that they had on the table that I still remember fondly include things like Tyrrells, which of course is a famous winery in the Hunter Valley, and Baileys of Glenrowan. And there were a few of the marks that I do remember my parents particularly loving, and they became legends in our family and something that I had in mind. But really, studying winemaking was not something that my parents had expected me to do. I had a teacher and a scientist as parents, and I had strong science. They expected something a little bit more technical or practical than the choice of winemaking that I did make. So that was a little bit of a leap.
Mind you, the science is hugely important. You went to Roseworthy, did you?
I went to Roseworthy, yes, off I went. So from New South Wales, country New South Wales, I headed to Roseworthy to study this winemaking course. It just sounded so romantic. It's hard for me to imagine what I really thought winemaking was going to be like when I did apply for it. But I think it was fairly quickly dispelled, and what it was really about became clear to me over the course of studying for that first year, that it was a lot more hands-on. There was certainly a lot of science, but there was a lot more tasting, which I had expected, but it was harder or something for me that was new to really taste in a technical way. Was something that I really had to work on. And you know, I guess my parents always had in the back of their mind that I might just get this out of my system and then go back and do a pure science degree or something like that. But when you study something that takes you to beautiful places in the world to live amongst people who love flavours, love food and wine and beautiful views and just having a good time, it's pretty hard to make a choice to turn away from that. So I never did.
You must be an inspiration, the pair of you, to other aspiring female winemakers.
Well, thank you, and we try to be to live up to that reputation. But I have to say that here in Coonawarra, we're not the only female winemaking duo anymore. There's a number around Coonawarra, and I find this as a place to work is one that really punches above its weight in terms of its women winemakers in this region, which is really pleasing to be able to say that it's no longer just Sue and I working as a team of women on wine in this great region.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, Australia, rightly or wrongly, sometimes has a reputation for that kind of slightly machismo culture. As I say, that might not be fair, you'll tell me, but have you, the pair of you, ever encountered sexist attitudes in the wine business in the many years that you've been in it?
Look, I'd say we probably absolutely have, but I think another thing that Sue and I share is an attitude of really not caring about that and just getting on with it, which it has worked for us. It's been our approach, is to just be confident and get on with the job and just speak with the people, men and women, whom we respect and who we feel supported by, and carry on in that way, which is not to say that that is an easy thing for all people to achieve. It's something that Sue and I have managed, and I feel very grateful that's how it's panned out for myself and for Sue. But that's not to belittle other people's experiences.
Sarah Pidgeon on her experience at Wynns. And staying in Australia, Louisa Rose has spent 30 years or so mastering the art of making Viognier at Yolumba, the country's oldest family-owned winery. In fact, she's often called the Queen of Viognier for her devotion to the variety. And she also takes a keen interest in sustainability, as she explained to me last year.
We can do what everybody can do, and what every business can do, and that is to try to improve. I think in terms of climate change, which is probably the biggest single issue for the wine industry, the global wine industry, that sort of, you know, race to net zero, if you like, is a really important milestone. And we can all do our bit to do that. We have, for example, 25% of our power is generated by solar panels on the roofs of our winery and buildings, which is so that renewable energy is, you know, it's obviously then, you know, making sure that, you know, the energy you're buying, is all the electricity you're buying, isn't coming from, you know, or even gas burners. We are also living in a state in South Australia which has a significant percentage of its electricity already generated by renewable resources. So we're lucky there, and that's where, you know, the importance of everybody working together comes along. We've done things like, for example, the Y Series glass, the bottle that it comes in. You know, we moved to a lighter weight glass a few years ago that has saved 20% of the, of the weight, which means that not only is there not as much energy used in the production of the glass, but the it's also less energy used to ship it. So the biodiversity that I mentioned before, is really important. You know, so cutting out, a lot of, excess fertilizers and things reduces greenhouse gases coming out of your soils. We have, for every hectare of vineyard that we have at least another hectare of native vegetation within and around our vineyards. Planting trees is always a good thing to try and sort of, heal the planet. So bit by bit, we're doing that. We're also members of the International Wineries for Climate Action, which is a group that started in 2019, I think. And the founding members were Torres from Spain and the Jackson family from California. And they've got together, and it is for like-minded wineries to get together and to work together. To measure and to calculate and then to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and get to zero net zero carbon by 2050. So that's the aim, and it's a really proactive group. You don't just join it and just for the fun of it. There's a lot of work you've got to do. And again, it's another one of these programs that is audited. You won't just be making claims about what you're doing. You'll have to prove it. The more and more, on a daily basis, we're finding more and more ways that we can change the things that we do. Just the refrigerants that we use, for example. We used to use in this industry a lot of, refrigerants that were, greenhouse gases. So, you reduce those, you reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that you use. So lots and lots of things.
And as you say, that initiative initiated by Torres and Jackson Family Vineyards, that it does involve some serious commitments. So you're right. You don't sort of do it half-heartedly. You talked there about working together. And I tend to think, and it may be a bit of a lazy stereotype, that sort of Australia has a little bit of a noisy male culture sometimes. And I've interviewed a number of pioneering female winemakers, and you are absolutely in that category with more than 30 years of experience winemaking. Have you ever had any grief from males being a pioneering woman doing the job that you do?
No, I really haven't. And you know why I think, we just don't, and I'm not saying it may well exist in the wine industry, but I've certainly never seen it, never experienced it. But I think the reason that for that is that, most people come into the wine industry because it's the wine industry, because it's about having a good time. It's about producing a product that's going to, improve people's lives and, be part of their memories and all their experiences. And that's pretty exciting. When we get together, and sure, there's been plenty of committees and things I've been on over the years that there haven't been other women there. But genuinely, people are just, in the wine industry, just, well, in Australia anyway, just really want to have a good time. So, that tends to sort of rule out too much sort of nasty behaviour.
Louisa Rose on her experience as a pioneering woman winemaker. Well, one of her protégés at Yulumba was Theresa Heutzenroder, who is now the senior winemaker at another of Australia's great names, Petaluma. She told me how she got into wine.
Well, I guess, I first had a love for science at school, and then I guess once I graduated from university, my first job, first day in the lab, I was like, oh no, actually this isn't really what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I guess the journey was sort of on after that to kind of find, what what I was going to do, what my passion, I guess my real passion was. And I guess I fell into the wine industry. I worked as a microbiologist for a couple of years and then joined your lumber as a microbiologist, which is quite a different proposition to being in a lab. And then I had a chance tasting with one of the young winemakers, because the tasting lab was actually right next door to the laboratory. And hey, there was a lineup of Australian Shirazes from all over Australia. And I was just like, I was just blown away by the differences between the structures of the wines, the aromas, the flavors, the textures. And I thought, you know what? This is what I want to do. So it was, you know, that was it. The light bulb came on and sort of went from there.
I really struggled with science at school. I was very much on the kind of, you know, the languages and that sort of creative side. How fundamental is a really good knowledge of science to being a winemaker?
Well, look, I mean, there is a lot of technicality about, you know, some aspects of winemaking, and I guess the science of it is quite important. I think perhaps red winemaking is more sort of intuitive and blending, whereas for me, I guess because a lot of my career has been spent with white and sparkling, that is very technical. So it is important, but I think, you know, you sort of can't have one without the other. The science is important, but, you know, when you're out in a vineyard, you're tasting fruit, you've got sort of analysis with you, but I guess the focus is really on how it tastes and I guess that's where the instinctive creative side sort of first starts, and it sort of goes from there as you go through. So you can't have one without the other, but yeah, they're both important. But for me, it's sort of a blend of the two, which has always been what I really love about winemaking.
If you were describing Australian wine to someone who had, you know, no knowledge of wine, what would you say makes Australia so special when it comes to wine?
Oh, I think that the fact that, you know, we don't have any constraints around our winemaking. We have a freedom to express the wine and the site how we choose. And I guess there's a lot of diversity in Australia. Obviously, it's big differences in regions. But, and I guess the personality, if I can use that, I don't know. I think it's just that we have the freedom to make the wines that we want to, without constraints around a style and the diversity that brings to all of the, you know, wine producers across Australia. I think, you know, that's something to be celebrated.
Something else to be celebrated is the sheer number of very successful, some would say pioneering, Australian women winemakers. And I appear to have spoken to a bunch of them on this program. And I've asked this question before, so I'll ask it to you as well. Have you ever encountered issues, problems doing your job in your sort of 25 odd years of doing it based on your gender?
No, I have to say, honestly, I haven't. I've had nothing but support and respect. And I know that's not always everyone's experience. And, you know, certainly things have changed and there's many more female winemakers than when I first started in the industry. And certainly cellar and viticulture are still very heavily weighted towards males. But I think that, you know, if you do a good job, doesn't really matter. Your gender doesn't matter, you know. And I guess I've been fortunate. I mean, the early days of my career, there was, you know, not that many female winemakers, but, you know, more and more, I guess, in the wineries that I've worked at, it's been actually quite a high proportion of female winemakers, so, which is probably not necessarily the industry average, but that's just my experience. And maybe that's because I've been in larger companies.
What would your advice be to others who might wish to emulate your success then?
I guess it just going into winemaking, I think I remember once one of my previous bosses said to me, it's a love job. And it certainly is. I mean, most winemakers are very passionate. But, you know, if you're about getting paid lots of money or doing 9 to 5, it's probably not the job for you. So I'd say you have to be prepared to work pretty hard and long hours. And I think you just need to be passionate. And I think probably ultimately you just need to be yourself, because there's many different, you just, yeah, be yourself and work hard.
Teresa Heutzenroder at Petaluma with her words of wisdom on how to succeed while crossing the Tasman Sea. One of a number of New Zealand's high-flying female winemakers, Natalie Christensen, is now chief winemaker at Yealands, with serendipity playing its part at the start of her illustrious wine career, as she explained to me.
I had what I like to coin my quarter-life crisis, so still do have a love of music and I play very occasionally, but back in the day I used to play a lot, and I was really interested in being a composer for New Zealand films when I first left high school. So I studied a music degree at university, but then I sort of decided I really liked the healing properties of music, so I thought maybe I would get into music therapy. I ended up doing a psychology degree as well, and I did a paper in industrial organizational psychology along the way, and I ended up doing my master's in that. Yeah, and so I worked in HR for 8 months and it was the pits. It was miserable. So yeah, that's when I had my quarter life crisis. I was 25, hopefully I lived to 100. Left my job, I had a massive student loan, I thought I'd ruined my whole life, and my brother was living in Marlborough at the time, and he said, maybe you just need to go traveling. Why don't you come to Marlborough and work a harvest? I had no idea really what a harvest entailed, but I thought, that sounds great. So I arrived in Marlborough in 2006, and I did my first harvest at St. Clair then, and I loved it. I couldn't believe it was a job and a career potential. And when I was studying my master's degree, I'd been a volunteer firefighter, so I was used to steel cap gumboots and pumps and hoses. And I also had a part-time job working in a local wine bar. And so these things I'd kind of been doing along the way, I hadn't really realised, had sort of set me up for an exciting and awesome future.
My God, that is...
Sorry, that was a bit of a long answer.
Well, there's a lot to get in. I mean, right. talk about sort of serendipity and things happening by accident. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people I talk to for the drinking hour who sort of fell into what they're doing. But this is, you know, quite a fall, given the enormity of the job you're doing now. So you've always, I guess, into wine, as an adult at least.
Yes. I mean, like, where I grew up and... I guess my main introduction into wine was sort of cask wine in the fridge that I used to sneak from my mum. But yeah, it wasn't until I really kind of got into the industry and obviously working in that wine bar that I started to really sort of gain knowledge and gain a full appreciation of wine.
You do live and breathe the kind of sustainability message, don't you? It's a big thing. I mean, New Zealand wine, pretty much every winery in New Zealand, bar a very small handful, are sustainable certified. It's the most extraordinary success, I think partly down to New Zealand wine growers just being very, you know, admirably militant about it. But why is it important, and what do you do on sustainability to try and kind of keep the game up?
Yeah, I guess so. Like the sustainable wine growing New Zealand, most producers are certified in that, and there's sort of a baseline of what you need to do to achieve that. But then there's wineries going sort of above and beyond that. So I mean, the likes of Yellens, we are carbon zero certified, and we go through an audit process every year, and basically we're on a journey to get to carbon positive. Yeah, some of the things that we've got going on, we've just launched a 30-year biodiversity plan, which sees us plant over 1 million native trees on the property. We're restoring a natural or a waterway that used to be there, so we've been working on a project with that. And when we first opened the winery, we had the largest solar panel array in New Zealand, and then we got pipped. But now we're about to pip someone out. So, yeah, we're about to put another big load in. Yeah, it's just for us, it's just constantly kind of monitoring and figuring out how we can lighten the load on the planet. And, yeah, and I think everyone's doing that these days. And I think it's important that we've got a commitment to it.
Yeah, you're arguably doing it more than most. But, I mean, it might sound like a really stupid question, but why is it important?
Well, I guess it's global warming. I guess it's protecting what we can and what we've got left. I know that there's so much damage that's already been done, and it's probably going to be actually very difficult to sort of stop that cycle, and who knows where we're heading, but we need to do whatever we can while we're still here and while we've still got a planet to work with. Mm. Yeah.
And talking of, doing the right thing, you're a prominent woman boss winemaker. There are quite a lot of women winemakers I can think of in New Zealand, kind of off the top of my head, actually. Mm. I don't know what the sort of male to female sort of ratio is. I'm not sure anyone's even worked that out. But how important is it to you to kind of encourage women into winemaking? Is there more that still needs to be done, do you think?
I mean, I started in the New Zealand industry, must be about 17 years ago. And to be honest, I didn't even realise that winemaking was a male-dominated industry because there were so many female winemakers around me, like Jules Taylor, Jane Hunter. You know, it just seemed normal. And it wasn't really until I learned a bit more about the industry and started traveling that I realized it's not normal. But I think now, today, you know, there's been lots of strong women who have paved the way. And yeah, even before I got in the industry, they'd sort of paved the way. So it's not really, it's not as much of a thing these days. Yeah.
You haven't encountered kind of sexist barriers then in your life making wine?
No, not especially. If anything, it's sort of played into my favour, like especially even my time in Spain. Yeah, people are quite supportive of it because you're such a strange thing that, yeah, people were supportive. I have never found it to be a barrier for myself personally.
Natalie Christensen at Yeelands in Marlborough. Corinne Seeley's winemaking pedigree looks classically French. A chemistry graduate, her first job was at Bordeaux's Chateau Lynch Barge, and she's made wine all over the world, from Australia to the Douro Valley, before settling in Hampshire as wine director at Exton Park Estate for the past decade. But her wine journey began with a glass ceiling that needed smashing.
All started when I decided to apply to the University of Enology in Bordeaux. I wasn't, my background was not from Bordeaux. And basically, my application was refused by the headmaster. I wasn't from Bordeaux. And basically speaking, I was a woman, David. So obviously, I couldn't change the second point, but I could do something about the first one. I had a good friend, the uncle was the owner of Chateau Lynch-Page. Jean-Michel proposed me to come, and I did my training over there. I mean, that was very lucky indeed.
And what did you learn at Chateau Lynch-Page?
I learned a lot and never stopped since then. I learned to roll my sleeves, certainly. I learned also to work closely with the vineyard team. You have to think that Lynch Barge is in the Médoc, near Bordeaux, and it's surrounded by, I think, 130 hectares of vines. So yes, to be in the vineyard, of being in the winery, and to work with the team. To share experiences and to have the will to work hard and then to be innovative. It was fascinating. I really, really fantastic memories to work with such a great team, really.
And you must have shown some considerable determination, because you mentioned there that basically the fact that you were a woman, that was an obstacle to you at that time. I hope it might not be now. I don't know. But how did you manage to sort of to resist that sort of pressure for you not to do it, to push forward with that determination that you've shown?
That's a very, very good point. There are always challenges in any job, particularly when you are a woman in a male-dominated industry. And this was definitely the case when I started my career. It is still a male-dominated industry today, but much less so than before. In England, I was asking GB Wines not so long ago that how many women are winemakers in England. I don't think there are a lot. Maybe 9, 10, 11. It's not a lot. I have been very lucky to be surrounded by supportive people in the early days of my career, and they recognized my ability, you know, which gave me confidence in myself. After working at Lynch-Page, I became one of the first young female winemakers at the head of a Grand Cru Classé in Bordeaux, Domaine de Chevalier. And this was a moment in time that I will never forget. It gave me, you know, the strength, the courage for the rest of my journey. It has been it's still a long journey. I wouldn't believe anyone who have said to me a long time ago that I was going to become a French winemaker working and making English sparkling wine, really. would have been a joke.
Well, it is pretty extraordinary, actually, the fact that you have this French pedigree and that you're in England. And I'm going to come to that in a minute because I'm sort of teasing it out. But in the meantime, you went and made wine elsewhere in the world as well, didn't you? You've got some quite considerable experience on your CV from leading wineries elsewhere in the world. What did you learn there? Where did you go, first of all, and what did you learn?
I have been for years what we call a flying winemaker at the time and around the world. I studied chemistry and soils, so I have been discovering all the different regions and terroir around the world, meeting people and sharing experiences. I still believe that you need to be curious to make your own way, your own decisions. And so it has been my journey until I finally meet England and the terroir of England and the climate of England. And it's because of having been a flying winemaker that I knew that England, and particularly Hampshire and Exton Park, have something special. Yes, I think a life never stopped. Your journey is still different every day, I believe that, and you cannot really decide in advance what it's going to be. And England has been a fantastic surprise for me.
Corinne Seeley at Exton Park in Hampshire. To another great English name, Nye Timber next, and a chief winemaker who hails from Canada. Sherry Spriggs works with her husband Brad Greatrix, and they've been a formidable double act for more than 15 years at Nye Timber, as it has grown in size and stature. So how do they both live and work together as well?
I mean, I guess there's a few elements that feed into this. One side is that, in fact, we don't know it any other way. Brad and I met when we were doing our undergraduate degrees. We were doing a bachelor's of science in Canada in biochemistry. And that's where we met. And we started our relationship even studying together. And then we went through our journey of getting into the wine industry, falling in love with wine together. So in one respect, we don't really know it any other way. But also, I like to say, I think sometimes working with your husband or wife could be difficult depending on your industry. You know, we're not two criminal lawyers who come home with a very stressful kind of world that we're dealing with. We're in the wine industry, and our industry is tough. It's hard. There is stress. There's no doubt. But it's also an industry of joy. We're doing what we do because we're making something that people share at some of their most pleasurable times of life. And that's probably the most fulfilling thing of our jobs. And we can very much connect on that. And we love wine. So, you know, we're sharing a common love in what we do. So that makes it all seem rather effortless.
Yeah, it makes sense. Do you always agree on things?
No. You know, when you've been together with someone for as long as Brad and I have been, and we've been tasting and working together for so long, there's a few things. One, we know each other's strengths and weaknesses. So there's certain times and certain areas where I will defer to Brad because I just know he's better at it than me in that particular area, and vice versa. Ultimately, if we don't agree and a decision has to be taken, that's mine to take. I'm the head winemaker responsible for the vineyard department and the winery department. So technically Brad reports to me, but most of the time, I think because our communication is, we've been working together for so long, our communication is so strong that we mostly can talk through and figure out what is the best solution rather than any hierarchical way of making decisions.
And he's always been very happy that ultimately you're the boss.
Yeah, and hopefully he's okay with that because I don't consider myself a tyrant.
No, he seems pretty cool with it, to be fair, whenever I've been anywhere near the pair of you. Let's talk about the other man you mentioned there, the boss, Eric Harima, a really key figure in the industry, you know, larger than life by any measure, and has clearly had an enormous influence on English sparkling wine, not just Nye Timber, because of what he has brought to Nye Timber. You clearly work very well, you and Brad, with Eric.
Very much so. First, if I come back to what I was saying about when we were choosing who we wanted to work with, what we found in Eric that you don't always find in owners and CEOs in the wine industry is someone who has an incredible amount of vision and has a driving force, and he does what he says he's going to do. He's extremely committed, and he looks at the wine industry in a very long-term way. He's not unrealistic about how long it takes to achieve what you want to achieve as a business in this industry. He's also, we bonded quite quickly over our love of wine. He is, I think, since a very young age, since he was a teenager, he has been a passionate wine lover and a wine drinker. And I think you need that. You want someone who's in love with what it is that you're making and trying to achieve. He's an extremely driven man. He's an extremely visionary leader, and he is able to see potential. And I think he could see potential when he took over Nye Timber that just wasn't there in the industry at the time. And he really, you know, we talk about those early days, and we talk about how it felt like we had to justify our existence. We knew what was possible, but there were things that needed to be worked on and improved on and fixed. So we knew where we could get to, and we had to prove that, and we had this to stay the course and do the hard work in order to make that happen. And you don't get that with every leader, that's very much my experience of Eric.
Sherry Spriggs, head winemaker at Nye Timber, on working with two significant men, husband Brad and the owner Eric Harima. Finally, to the doyen of wine writing, Master of Wine Jancis Robinson, OBE. Her scores wield such influence that she must surely now be the world's most famous wine critic. So how did her wine journey begin?
I know you're a very good researcher, David. Yes, it is. But then I'm so old that practically none of my contemporaries were brought up with wine. I had to wait till I got to university. I went to Oxford, and it all felt very exciting after having been brought up in a tiny village in Cumbria. And I had a boyfriend then whose father gave him a bit too much money. And some of that was spent on wining and dining me, to the extent that I actually became the restaurant correspondent of the Oxford University magazine. And we went one night to a restaurant called the Rose Revive. And for some reason, I think because the name sounded lovely, we ordered a bottle of 1959 Chambol Musigny Les Amoureuses, a wine that nowadays I wouldn't be able to afford, but then was better than the student Planck that was my regular drinking. And I could sense that in this liquid, there was so much, you know, there was history, geography, psychology, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't get up from the table saying, right, I'm going to be a wine writer, but it certainly lit the flame. But what most people don't realise is that back then, and we're talking about the early 70s, the subjects of wine and food had nothing like the status that they have today. They were seen as being kind of terminally frivolous. You wouldn't, if I'd said to my friends, I'm going to become a wine writer, they'd have said, what a waste of an Oxford education. You know, very different, isn't it?
In 1984, you were the first non-wine trade person to earn those letters MW, as I mentioned in the introduction. I'm wondering if you were one of the first women to also achieve that.
Not especially. I think I was something like the 10th woman or so. There are a couple of
women masters of wine in this, who passed these horrible week-long exams in the 70s. And then there was a great rush of women in the early 80s. Yeah. So it's, and nowadays, it's just amazing the number of people who sign up to do the Master of Wine study course. Far more students, MW students, than there are actually MWs now, and they're from all over the world. And it is, it's a real trial. I mean, it, you know, you're tested not just on your writing and your knowledge, but on your tasting ability. You've got, there are three papers where you walk into the exam room and there are 12 glasses in front of you, and you've got to, you know, nothing about them, and you've got to assess and identify them as closely as possible and answer all sorts of questions about them. And as the wine world expands, of course, so does the syllabus. So I'm not at all sure I could pass it today.
I'm sure you could. But anyway, you were pregnant when you passed the MW exams, and you write that you think that that may actually perversely have helped. That would surprise a lot of people. How do you think it helped?
I think it helped. Well, as women will who've had children will know, your taste becomes very, very sensitive when you're pregnant. So I was tasting pretty well. I was also practicing like mad, because it's a bit like an Olympic sport. You need to be in condition for the for a blind tasting exam. And also, I wasn't tempted to actually drink the stuff. You know, I think that probably there were some desperate people in the exam room who kind of got a bit confused and thought they'd console themselves with a mouthful of it. But I felt like spitting the whole lot out. The child who I was carrying then has turned out to be the one of our three who is most interested in wine.
Oh, there you go. Well, you've been very supportive of those who have been victims of sexism in the wine trade, and more broadly, I'm sure, than just the wine trade. But you seem also, from everything you've said, to have escaped that misfortune yourself over the years.
I've been very, very lucky not to have consciously experienced any discrimination at all. In fact, sometimes the reverse. There was a great rash of articles in the 1980s about female wine writers. I think that I think that a lot of women, particularly in hospitality, experience a terrible degree of sexism and sexual harassment, fully unaware of, because I've never actually experienced it myself. So I do feel a responsibility to call it out and support women in wine. I think it's my luck is that I've never had to sell wine, and I've never worked in a restaurant or even a wine company. I've never worked in the wine trade. I'm a kind of parasite on the wine trade, commenting about it. And of course, wine producers want to be nice to me because they want a nice high score and, you know, on their wines and things like that. So I've been very, very lucky, but not all women have.
Jancis Robinson, OBE, MW, talking to me back in 2021, and she's currently recovering from illness. So we wish her well on this International Women's Day.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode, in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
And we round off, as ever, with medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame. Our focus for our brief selection today, women winemakers and distillers, those we have featured, in fact. A gold medal winner from Dr. Rachel Barry's stable first, with a whopping 98 points. The Glendronach Distillery 21-year-old Parliament Single Malt Scotch Whisky. The judging panel includes some of the great names of whisky, Richard Patterson, OBE, David Stewart, MBE, Sandy Hislop, Becky Paskin, and our good friend Joel Harrison too. And they said this: rich fruitcake on the nose with sweet and spicy cloves, leading to a balanced palate of dark chocolate, savoury notes and firm tannins, giving complexity and balance, and finishing on a long, juicy raisin mouthfeel. Next, a gold medal winner from the Yolumba stable, Ringbolt Cabernet Sauvignon 2021, this from Margaret River, judged in situ in the region last year, winning 95 points. The judges described a classic expression of everything that's made Margaret River a standout Cabernet region. Vibrant and intense on the nose, with wafts of fresh mint, sea spray and dark brambly cassis. Complex, effortlessly elegant and sure to reward patient ageing. Next, from Natalie Stable, Yeelands Estate Single Vineyard Albarino 2022 won very strong silver with 93 points. Natalie, a real champion for Albarino, having worked with the variety in the Rhea Spicious. And this one is from the Auateri Valley. I was on the judging panel for this and we said an expressive nose of peaches and cream, swirled with orange blossom and a touch of underlying salinity. The palate is fresh with tropical fruits and a lively citrus finish. From our judging in situ in Argentina next, one of the Catena wines, DV Catena, Pinot Noir 2021, a strong silver medal winner with 92 points. This from the altitude vines of Qualtallery. Our tasting note, aromas open to a complex combination of red, ripe orchard fruits, herbs, mint and tobacco. Palate is bright and full of juicy fruits. Tannins are smooth and balanced. A lovely finish. And I was on the judging panel for this one too, finally, from Sarah Pidgeon and Sue Hodder's stable, Wynn's Kunawara Estate Michael Shiraz 2018, a silver medal winner with 91 points. And here's the tasting note. Textured and dense, sweet blackberry, blackcurrant, gentle and balanced tannins. Long, juicy finish, highlighting subtle spice and herbal notes. And that's it. My thanks to all of the great women we have featured on the Drinking Hour over its life and those who have appeared today in our special edition to mark International Women's Day. Until next time, goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Oenologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.